to build this cathedral, and I'm not going to be alive that long, right? Both of those are going to push you to group effects. Could also be the spread of the problem,
right?
We need to be looking all over the Lower East Side for X at the same time. So I can't do that myself. I can't cover that area myself. So another reason you can push to groups is mix up skills, right? We need someone to do the database. We need someone to do the server side work. We need someone to do the front end. We need someone to do the marketing. It might be possible, right, to find one person with all of those skills, at which point you kick yourself back to a time effect. But it's less likely that the mix of skills is going to push you into a group environment. Then there are classes of goals that can only be pursued by groups. Two of the ones that we've talked about in here that are of particular interest to us are public goods. And a public good, this is drawn from Manchester Olson's Logic of Collective Action. A public good is any good that is easier to provision for the group than for the individual. Or, put another way, once it exists, it's hard to exclude individuals from enjoying it. Right? I go and I build a lighthouse, and all of the houses along the beach are then protected from ships wrecking into them. Right? It would be hard for me to exclude your house from the protection offered by the lighthouse. So if I go door to door asking for money to fund the lighthouse, what problem am I going to run into?
Well, there's no threat of not being included, so why would I pay?
Right, and that's the logic of collective action problem, which is once you have to provision the thing for the group as a whole, it's very difficult to get individual contributions to add up to this. It's not impossible, but you need very special characteristics. When you think of something which is provisioned for a whole group but paid for by only a minority, that has a fund drive twice a year that annoys it.
PBS
and NPR are one of the few examples we have of things that are provisioned as public goods. I'm broadcasting airwaves. It doesn't get less exclusive than that. I cannot lock you out of tuning in your television or your radio. And yet, I have to raise the money to do it from individuals because I can't use tax dollars. Right? What's the solution there?
Cool. I mean, a lot of them take corporate contributions.
Right. No, sure. But in terms of getting money from individuals, right, what's the solution?
Annoy them.
What's that?
Annoy them.
Right. And the problem, what's the problem with annoying them?
You risk losing your listeners.
What's that? You risk losing your listeners. And what else? What do you wish you could do if you do give money to PBS or NPR?
Well, you want to take an active role in, maybe not an active role, but you, in other words, like acknowledgement for your contribution. They say your name over the air.
Okay.
Like, they give you.
But what do you really want during the fund drive?
From the shut up.
You want to shut up, right? Like, all right, just manage 30 seconds. Give me the one I tune into where it goes back to being regular NPR. I mean, this is the weird problem. But they have a collective action problem, even within this collective action problem. Right? I've always thought that, at least, as we go to streaming, right?
That's
you should start a fund drive. You get the secret URL, but during the fund drive, you get to tune into the real stream that doesn't have the fund drive, right? But so even within public goods, there are lots of solutions, and as always within this class, those kinds of solutions produce other kinds of problems. But public goods are one class of group goal that, in addition to these, which are just groups are good, here groups are absolutely necessary. You can't even get at these kinds of things without groups. Fukuyama kind of blows by the idea that social capital doesn't have to be provisioned as a public good because obviously individuals will provision for themselves everything they need. I don't believe that. Again, this is a debate. I'm much less of a libertarian than Fukuyama, but it seems like the Italy counterexample, which he himself gives, shows that you can have situations in which individuals don't produce public goods. In any case, you need some sort of overall policing to fight off social media. The other class of group goals that can only be provisioned for a group are solidarity goods. Things that are only valuable because everybody does them. What side of the street should you drive on?
Same side as everybody else.
Same side as everybody else. There was a great thing in, I think it was in the Financial Times, saying that the UK was going to switch to driving on the same side of the street as the rest of Europe, but so that this wouldn't be such a big problem, they're going to phase it in for the first 6 months and just apply to buses and taxis. the fact that's a joke is what underlies this, right? There are some things which are good precisely because and only because groups do. If you own the only car in the world, there would be no solid, there would be no value at all in driving on this side or that side of the road. Right? So in some cases, groups solve problems that only groups have, because groups are first world right. So if that was all there was to it, this would not be worth having a class about. Problem two, or issue two. People are autonomous and social, right? And it's these two things together that are the engine for almost every effect we look at in this class, right? People have both individual actions and they have social choices. And this is what I meant when I said, under what circumstances would you go to a movie you hate and or you suspect you will hate? And the answer is, when the social value or the social sanctions tip the value of making a constant choice about going to a movie. This is a fundamental tension, right? Which is to say, it is as it baked into groupness. There is no permanent solution to this tension. We've seen several versions of it. Bayan raised the psychological tension, right? The actual tension in the sort of mental functioning, and came up with the formulation that humans are hopelessly committed to both, that we're both autonomous actors and we're social actors. And that there's no way out of that. There's no way out of that dilemma. All you can do is manage it. In particular, I think Bayan's sense that groups are torn between being basic groups, which is to say, driven by basic human urges, and trying to be sophisticated work groups, which say groups with goals, is a big part of that tension. Right, managing those two things. In order to survive this problem, or as a result of this problem, groups have to be both effective and satisfying. Right? The group has to accomplish whatever its goal is, and the individual members have to be satisfied about their membership. Now, both of these are relative terms. Right? Life in the army may not be terribly satisfying, but it has to be more satisfying than the horrors of going AWOL, or people will go AWOL. Right? So satisfaction can actually be absence of a negative, like not being thrown in the brig, rather than the presence of a positive. But the group also has to be effective. Right? It has to produce some value that the individuals can't get on their own. So you can't just go to pure satisfaction. You also have to have some kind of effectiveness. I think we've.
So this just applies to voluntary groups. Yeah.
What's that? No, it's actually. I'm saying this applies to all groups because involuntariness is really just a raising of the sanctions. In fact, you could go AWOL from the army. And so you could regard your own, or the movie example, right? Maybe you're in the class and there's some, you know, the threat of the grade. So within the context of, I'm a student, this is a class, I'm worried about my grade, it feels involuntary. I can drop the class.
I mean, what about something like prison or a chain gang or something?
Even then, there are ways of opting out, which is to say, participation in the system is better than rioting, right?
Or getting shot.
Right, or getting shot.
I was actually more in the effective aspect. Like, in an involuntary group, is that an effective group?
Oh, I see what you're saying. An involuntary group, the effectiveness has to come from the social judgment, right? We've got right now a social judgment that it is more effective to lock up nonviolent drug users than to put them in prison than to let them out on other kinds of things. And there's obviously significant debate about that. We may change our minds on that issue within the next 5 years. So when it's involuntary, the judgment of effectiveness doesn't come from the participants. It comes from the event of society. Voluntary groups and voluntary extended fairly far to even things like membership in school. I think everyone has been in a meeting where everyone in the meeting has had a great time and nothing has gotten done. Right? You know, you're supposed to meet, get a project done for class, get together, have a great time, and you never actually get down to making the hard choices. Now, it may be that that meeting is building up some necessary sort of trust frameworks, necessary social capital, and so forth. So it's not enough to look at one meeting. But you can imagine groups that aren't effective over time go away for one reason or another. So there's this balance between effective and satisfying that is essentially pushed into the group because of the tension between autonomy and social action. So, as a result, these three groups, having groups, is the art of managing these problems. Right? The core problem, the core problem, because what's core really depends on your view. The view in this class is around the kinds of problems that result from A and B both being true. Formation issues. How do you get the group started? It's striking to me that many of the papers talk about latent groups and how to get them started. Jan was talking about people who are self-identifying as artists and wanting to make not just aesthetic or design objects, but art. And talking about how do you get those groups to identify to each other. Or Jackie's example of trying to start Thursday night out on Tuesday, right? As a, there's some startup cost here. So how do you form a group? Because of the paradoxes of groups problem. There's no group without members, but there's no members without a group. So the moment of formation is this weird moment where people effectively agree that they'll share a belief in a social fact. And until that yet moment.
So what you mean by problems here is managing the problems inherent to being in a group?
Yes. I'm sorry. What I mean is this, right? Because they're necessary, you can't get out of it. You can't just say, let's not have a group, because you're taking on a problem that requires a group. But because there's tension in each member between the autonomy and the social aspect of the group, you then have this forced move that's also problematic. And as a result, all kinds of issues fall out from that. And no matter what context the groups are forming in or what the goal of the group is, you end up managing one of these problems. In a way, the problems is probably too dire, because in many ways the solutions to these problems can be not just creative, but can actually free up the group to do things that couldn't be accomplished in any other way. So there's the paradox of groups problem. There's also the constitutional crisis problem. The constitutional crisis is what happened in the first day when the group as a whole was deciding. And the question was, how do we decide how to decide? You could see this happening in slow motion in Iraq with the design of the constitution, where the idea was essentially to build this kind of stepladder function of make a group that decides who the group to make the constitution. Make a group to decide who the parliamentary election would be for. Then, from within the context of the parliament, make a group who designs the constitution. Then, design the constitution. Then, ratify the constitution. Then, elect new representatives. And the idea was that by doing this iteratively, and in the spirit of iterating games of British dilemma, you get out of the constitutional crisis. And what just happened? I don't know if anybody's following the Iraqi constitution. What just happened?
I remember hearing something about certain groups defecting.
Who's defecting?
The Sunnis are defecting.
The Sunnis are defecting because they were previously they're a minority group, the majority Kurdish and Sunni minority, but they were previously charged with Anad. But because the document was written by the Kurds and Shiites, what was the problem with the constitution?
Representation?
Right, didn't represent the Sunnis well. In fact, it was Sunnis are complaining that it's trying to carve up the country in a way that under-involves the Sunnis. So they just changed the constitutional rules to say the constitution as a document is not inviolable. And in fact, the group we elect is going to have much more direct access to changing its terms.
Wasn't there something about a provision written in there that at one point in time it stated that some things couldn't be changed until 8 years out?
Yes.
Which basically excluded everybody from who wasn't in, almost for a decade, but then they changed it to say it's up for immediate review now.
Yes, and this is exactly it. The Sunnis said, basically the Constitution was, these rules are inviolable. And the city said, if they're not on the table, we're not voting for this, because if we join the government, we have to be able to affect it. So you can see in, I don't know if it's exactly in slow motion, but certainly played out on the world stage, exactly the kinds of issues that are in. Another thing they did in the the city constitution is they were defining the voting blocks as being the overall populations of the respective regions, not just the people who voted. And this would have had the effect of making it essentially a lock, even if all the cities opted out. So, as with the question we've brought up here, who is a member of the group, right? Membership definitions, again, one of the remarkable things when you start looking across group effects is how few basic patterns there are and how much, there's a great deal of variation in how they play themselves out, but the basic patterns of formation issues of paradox of groups and of membership questions play out over and over again. Issues of trust and social capital, right? How is it in the context of the group? How do I transfer enough trust to the existence of the group that it does things like start to say, I'll lend you $20 because we're both at ITP? I was incredibly struck 2 years ago when I did a class called Social Software. It was a production class for making a number of social tools. Two of the projects that came up in that class required the exchange of money. And we had outside reviewers in for the midterm. And the outside reviewers all got so excited. Those getting excited about money is back in 2003 about, involving money in these kinds of systems. Everybody was talking about escrow systems and eBay reputation markets and how are you going to do this? Such a fascinating complex problem. And both of the groups said, we're not going to do any of that stuff because if somebody doesn't pay up, we're going to broadcast their name to the list. Right? And there was a completely extrinsic social solution to the risk of money, which you couldn't do on an internet-wide system. Right? If you were going to design a system for the entire internet, you need something like PayPal plus eBay plus an escrow market plus reputation and so forth. But within ITP, they said, we don't need any of that stuff because as long as we know your net ID, everything else can be taken care of out of band using the reputation capital before. So ranges and ranges of solutions here, but as with the conversation before the break about social capital, a huge issue of the formation of groups, because the group isn't strong enough that people would trust the members to engage in activity, even if it's just trusting them not to waste their time, or trusting that short-term wasting of time is still going to yield some kind of long-term payout. And because everybody knows that the one universal in any kind of group gathering is at some point it's boring, right? Because it's whatever's happening can't be uniformly interesting to each person all the time, right? You'll have this experience. Probably the only place this experience happens actually in the group as a whole is Redis class, where some section of the class, Vito Conchi is the best thing that ever happened. And another section of the class, like, where's the technology? So, right, and yet Redis class as a whole is a fantastic producer of social capital in the first year. So, the kinds of trust and social capital issues are in part saying, I'll continue to be a member because the long-term payout is going to add up to more than just, this has been boring for 5 minutes and I leave it. And you have to have those kinds of effects to get the groups to go here. There are all of the logic of collective action problems. And one of the remarkable things about groups is there's all kinds of interesting things that happen at minimum thresholds, and as you start to scale up, there's all these kinds of negative effects that start to build up, like not pulling your weight, but still taking advantage of the group as a whole. I can tell you from watching group projects from the outside, and having some sense between having access to the code base and having access to the sort of conversational laws and so forth, that an imbalance between the most and least active member of something like 4-to-1 is pretty normal, right? And that when it gets to 10-to-1 or something in that range, then it's quite extreme and then I have to intervene. But in fact, in groups, there's almost, everybody always says, everybody gave 110% all the time and it's never, ever true. Right. I mean, unless it's short-term and everybody worked for exactly the same 2 hours or whatever. But when these effects build up over time, group projects, when they work at ITP, almost always work because there's one person who's doing an unusually, an unusually large amount of the work outsized relative to their, you know, subdivision. And there's one person who's doing the least work, and that's actually across a fairly wide range. And effectively, what that is, it comes out of the wash, right? But there's not, the logic collective action problem doesn't just kick in when these things break. It actually is part of the system all the time. If you design a system that assumes each group member is going to be equally contributing all the time, that system will break. Yeah, yeah.
Did we ever answer the question of how you figure out who is the person least contributing, like the table example that you had where we all try to move the table?
That's an easy question. So there's two answers. One which is, there's two factors. How observable is the effort, right? So one of the reasons small groups work better than large groups is in small groups the variation in effort is more observable, right? If you're in a group of three people working in a class, you know if someone's not pulling their weight. If it's a group of 10, it's much, much harder to tell. If it's a group of 100, it's very difficult to tell. There's also things, extrinsic things, like you can look at code check-ins, right? So here's a weird thing about open source efforts. When you look at code check-ins, it's almost always a power law distribution, right? With a handful of people doing a huge number of check-ins and most people doing very few check-ins. But if you look at the mailing list, there's always one person who's extremely active on the mailing list and doing no code check-ins at all. And that person is the de facto project manager. Not appointed, but they kind of arise in successful projects. So if you just look at the code check-ins, that person looks like a loafer. If you look at the mailing list transactions, that person looks like a coordinator. So you have to kind of pick your measures.
What's code checking?
A code check-in. So if I'm writing code and I say, okay, I think I have this patch for the security flaw, I check it in, and it goes with my name on it. So we can start to count, you know, whose name goes to what piece of code. And when you look at, you know, the Linux kernel, it is, you know, long flat tail and a handful of, you know, minus and halogen and so forth.
There's also like a century worth of, like, you know, starting with Taylorism, of attempts to like metricize people's productivity and like how much work they're doing.
The problem with Taylorism was the idea that they would study the workplace and get the absolute most efficient way to do it. It was sort of trying to turn people into machines. The problem with Taylorism is it tends to squeeze out group effects, which is to say it assumes that people are just replaceable cogs in the machine, and it doesn't allow for much individual variation in the workplace.
Yeah, very deliberately.
Very deliberately so, but it's not a good way in a way, because people's contribution to a group, one person is going to be contributing perhaps a great deal of imaginative spur and kind of enthusiasm and bringing in external examples. Another person may just be coding their heart out.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it works, but there's a huge history of, and not just Taylorism, like other attempts to like figure it out. And often they fail.
Do you think that the unionization of workers is a direct result? Forming a group of unionized workers is a direct result of Taylorism?
No, I think, unions predated Taylor.
Unions unions were predated by guilds and so on. Unions are here, which is each worker negotiating on their own would like to negotiate a higher wage, but even more than that, they'd like to have a job. Which means if the risk of negotiating a higher wage is losing your job, then there's no way to negotiate a higher wage. And it is only when you can provision the higher wages as a public good. So unions, and this is where the Manchester Olson research started, logic collective action, which is people at the time were puzzled that unions were using coercive force to get people to join and participate. And Olson said, just look at the math, right? You can't not use coercion at large scale to get a union to coordinate. Because if I'm a union member, but I don't have to go to any meetings or join any strike pickets, but I still get the higher wage, sweet. Right? So if everybody makes that calculation, there is no union. Right? I mean, it's the problem of, you know, my son's things at camp are the things that the name isn't written on. And that problem expanded is the public good problem. So the other answer, the question you had is that people turn out to be biologically more adept at and more willing to look for cheaters and punish them than is economically sensible. There was a fascinating game where there was a two-person game. They gave person A $10, and they said, you can split with person B, and you can give them any amount of money. You have to give them some amount of money. split between the two of you. And that person can only do one of two things. They can take the money, or they can leave the money. And the only effect that has, besides they're getting the money, is if they don't take their money, you won't get your money. Neoclassical economics said no matter what the split is, you will take the money because you don't have a dollar. I say, here, I got 10 bucks. Here's a dollar. If you say no, you don't get a dollar. Right? So a century of neoclassical economics said every human being, or you know, to a first approximation, will take any amount of money that's offered. And in fact, if it was $3 or less, people almost uniformly defected. Right? They were specifically spiteful, despite the fact that the spite earned them nothing, because they were punishing, or you were punishing me, for not giving them a fair share. So if people did 6 and 4, or I'm sorry, it was 1 or 2. If people did 6 or 4 or 7 and 3, the receiving person took it. But beneath that, they would actually punish their partner even if it cost them to do so. So one of the remarkable things about human society is, and it's actually a big producer of social capital, is people will spend extra effort to detect and punish cheaters even if it's not economically rational. And that's a big effect. I mean, that's a good.
Would be economically rational in the long term because.
Well, see, this is the thing. The designers, neoclassical economics assumes that there's almost no prisoners in the sense. There is no shadow of the future. It would be economically rational in the long term if you were going to continue to do business with that person. And the hypothesis is humans are unable to calculate very well around random interactions with people they don't know. Because that happened in our evolutionary past almost not at all. And so strangers are this really weird category, or at least a minority category. And even if the experimenter tells your rational brain, assume that you will never do business with this person again, or you will never have an interaction with this person again, you still assume you will. Right? And so you are behaving as if you're iterating, and it is a kind of prisoner's dilemma game of, you just defected on me by giving me one lousy dollar. I know you've got nine in your pocket, so I'm going to get you, even though it's going to cost us both. Which is economically not sensible, but socially sensible if you're operating in a group. So yes, I think that's a big part. And finally, governance. In terms of the art of managing problems, rules for losing. Right. This gets back to why would you go to a movie you hate? Right. Why would you be willing to lose a vote? Right. You wanted it to be one way, and it went another way. So why don't you just pick up and leave? And the answer is always, because the value of the group is higher to you. And there's a bumper sticker that says, not my president, right? The only people who put that bumper sticker on their cars are people who are lying, right? No one would move here from another country and get that bumper sticker because, in fact, it's not your president. You don't need to put that bumper sticker on, right? So that is a kind of a declaration because it's not actually true. Right? The effect of voting, if then the effect of democracy, is to provide rules for losing. Right? And there are lots and lots and lots of ways of doing rules for losing. I don't want, you know, there's no way to exhaust them. But you need to have them. Very often the rules for losing are informal. People are just kind of keeping track of karma. Well, this week we went bowling, and bowling isn't your favorite, so next week we'll go roller skating isn't my favorite. It doesn't necessarily need to be a written constitution. In fact, it's often not. But to keep group cohesion, you need this. In fact, I proposed, 2 years ago, I proposed an experiment. There's a game called Gnomic, which we'll look at later in the class. But the game is a set of rules, including rules for changing the rules. And the game is changing the rules. It's not the funnest game in the world, but if you're a constitution geek, you know, it's a sort of a touchstone. But one of the things that I sort of playing off of this, you will sometimes get in massively multiplayer games, you'll sometimes get votes for things like, should players be able to kill other players, right? And this debate comes up all the time. It inevitably gets down to a vote. Almost invariably the vote is no in cities, yes in the countryside, or that's the sort of, or no in some shards or some worlds or some, on some servers and that.
Isn't there a game that's entirely based around that? Kind of more.
What's it?
I forgot what it's called, like Age of Civilizations or something, and the whole game is a massively multiplayer online game where you create the laws and like build up society.
There have been a bunch of games with relatively classic constitutions. I'll look up Age of Civilization. I don't know.
I'm not certain that's the name. It's massive in its relative scale, like 10,000 players or something.
But you can imagine, because massively multiplayer games can split all the time, you can imagine a game which you could call Fork World, where every time there was a vote, everybody who voted yes went to one server, and everybody who voted no went to another server, and the rules were implemented on those two servers, right? And at the end of some number of voting, everyone would have a world perfectly suited to their rules, and they would be the only person there, right? So it would be exactly the world you want, and it would be the least fun game in the world because there would be no one to talk to. So that's why you need rules for wisdom, right? Because the cohesion of the group as a whole is often worth sacrificing autonomy for. One of the things we'll talk about later is we have just lived through, how long has it been now? 30 years of the design center for technology being the personal computer, right? And so everything privileging autonomy, often to the point of dampening or damaging group effects, because the assumption of strengthening autonomy is actually one of the things that pushes groups away from this sort of thing, and the attendant social effects you get in those spaces. So, taking these three things as givens, groups are born of instability. For a group to survive, it needs space for conflict. It needs some way of both resolving conflict and widening the sort of conceptual space the group exists in beyond the absolutely defined goals of the group, so that when these instabilities or tensions manifest themselves, the group isn't so rigidly constructed that it blows up. There's a spectrum of cohesion. We talked about this a couple of classes ago with the idea of weak and strong groups. We listed a number of the effects. Group members identify themselves as members. Outsiders identify themselves as having shared characteristics. There's shared effort. There are shared outcomes. The question we're asking ourselves is, A, where on the spectrum of cohesion does a group exist and why? And B, what could you do to move it along that spectrum of cohesion? And one of the common things in the papers, which I was very pleased to see, is you could do this to make the group larger, denser, more cohesive, more effective, but that would have these downsides. Right? So the spectrum of cohesion, strengthening creates risks. Right? For instance, in the context of the social capital debate, increasing social capital in one group potentially decreases the social capital of the out group. Right? One of the complaints I've heard consistently at ITP, again, when these kinds of social conversations come up, is how little collaboration there is with other departments at TISH. And that seems to be a structural effect, right? We are contiguous and compact on the fourth floor, and it's very difficult to extend those tendrils. Some students do it individually, but as a whole, it seems like ITP's emphasis on internal social capital actually weakens our ability to collaborate with the rest of TISH. And that other departments have made different trade-offs. So that ain't a question of right or wrong, but it's strengthening creates risks. Risks like groupthink, risks like inability, you know, the sort of collaborative interface and so forth. The potential for exclusiveness, as with the KKK, Group viability. Item number five. Group viability is when the value of the group exceeds its cost. Right? To make it the most basic, right? But keeping the group together is a more sensible activity than allowing it to fall apart. And that comes with two big asterisks. Asterisks is how you pronounce that. The first is that the founding hurdle makes it difficult to get into that situation, right? You can imagine groups that would be valuable enough to stay together if they formed, but there are sometimes founding hurdles that make it too difficult to form that group. And the second is that groups exhibit homeostasis. There is, and not merely economically, there is something psychologically that makes a group that has come together tend to privilege staying together versus disbanding. Right? If you went to the board of directors of the New York Times and said, imagine that this group had $100 million, would you found a newspaper tomorrow? No way. no way in this environment they found a newspaper. They have, they're having so much trouble running the newspaper they've got. But that doesn't mean that they're going to dismantle the New York Times, try and sell it for the amount of cash they can get for it, and do something else. So the possibility space that the New York Times exists in is homeostatic. In addition, there are psychological forms of homeostasis. My mother was on, stop me if I've told this story before, my mother was on the Chancellor's Advisory Council, Chancellor's Advisory Council for International Affairs at the University of Missouri. And the University of Missouri is landlocked by other U.S. states. So there's no international borders, right? So there wasn't a big pressure to have, you know, a lot of international efforts. The international efforts that did happen were often through outreach programs to Africa through the agriculture school. And at one point, when the Chancellor's Advisory Board was meeting, the conversation got around the idea that the Chancellor had never asked this group's advice, and that they'd never actually done anything, but they still existed. And people sort of agreed that the group was dumb, that there was no real reason to have this. And someone actually made a formal motion to vote themselves out of existence. And they were just gearing up to do that when someone said, you know, what if we tried X? And my mother said you could feel the feeling of relief in the room, right? That some hope had been held out that this group, which everyone had already publicly admitted was useless, could somehow be rescued so that they wouldn't have to vote themselves out of existence, right? And there is, in addition to the economically homeostatic effects of the New York Times, there are sort of psychologically homeostatic effects. When a group exists, the presumption that should continue to exist for some set of mysterious reasons adds to this value and cost equation, which is not just a direct, is this valuable right now, but the kind of historical resonance add something to holding the group together. This is exactly what Megan was trying to do when she was trying to hide the origin of dry flies, is to create the illusion that process already had achieved that kind of homeostasis, even though it hadn't. Right? And that's why she was trying to do that. She wouldn't have put it in those terms, I think, but that's why she was trying to do that. So this is the background to the design problem. Does that make sense? Does that hold together the story? Have I missed anything? Did anything jump out at you from previous classes or from the readings that I haven't, in an admittedly highly condensed way, tried to account for here? Okay, because this is the story that I want us to be able to tell ourselves now in future discussions. Because this is, I think, the background of the design problem. So, item 6, which is the open-ended item, is design issues. This list is potentially infinite, so I don't mean to suggest that what I'm putting up is exhaustive, but I do want to cover the things we've talked about already, at least in large. Every one of these effects was touched on in one place or another. It's found in context. Is it intrinsic or extrinsic? The two-axis grid we did. What goals does the group have? And I mean group goals, not just what are the goals of the individual members, but what can the group advance? What are the resources the group have? Tasks and tools. Someone made the very interesting point, I think, talking about Red's class. that Red's class is more of a tool than a task, which I thought was quite an interesting observation. Effectively, it is a tool for creating, jump-starting, really, the conversation at ITP. And that at last, the traditional class sense of a directed inquiry into a narrow subject, it's in fact a divergent rather than a convergent class, and so it's more tool than task, right? So you can start to obviously find spaces between a lot of these things. So the question of who's a member of the group, the question again of governance, the question of scale, the question of exit conditions. Very interesting question raised by a couple of the papers, which is talking about groups at ITP and talking about longevity. And there's two kinds of longevity. There's TNO style longevity, where there's a standing wave and the members change. And then there's membership longevity, where a group of people stay together after they leave ITP. And you can imagine groups in which both things happen, right? This group founded something and stayed together, and also the activity they founded continued at ITP. So there are all kinds of exit conditions. When should this end? In some cases, the people leave, but the pattern stays. In other cases, vice versa. In other cases, both. From here on in, we'll be looking at specifically technological, that sounds too dry, but specifically mediated interventions into these kind of design questions.
Any use of a media as a core defining element of a group is, in a sense, mediating?
Yes. And the one caveat I will put on that, it's not absolute, it's just a tendency, is the broadcast of norms are less interesting than conversational tools. So having a newsletter, while a mediated part of creating, say, shared awareness in a group, is less interesting than SMSing among the group members or using a wiki to sort of coordinate group information or a listserv. So, yes, any media, but broadcast media effect, in part because they've already been factored into the way we think about groups, we assume that everybody has access to Kinkos and so forth, and in part because they're relatively uncomplex, being one way and a fairly trivial pattern. If you start to look at those broadcast effects, I'd be interested in knowing what can you do to improve them or alter them in the direction of engagement of the members or interactivity. But yeah, anything that is outside people in a room talking together is medium. And that's what we're interested in. I had asked you to, actually let's start there. First of all, does that seem to fall out from, or is it clear how that falls out from the previous five assertions? That there's this large set of design issues, the groups have a high degree of plasticity across those issues, and that there's no free lunch. Right? You can't do anything that make groups better in some, sprinkle salt on the taste improves way. There are things you can do to make groups better because you change the equilibrium of groups, but you have to understand what the trade-offs are. And in some cases, the law of unintended consequences can actually make what you're trying to do worse than what you started with. And that managing those trade-offs is now the way it comes. Yes?
What about physical space? I mean, gathering together, this is... the first article that we were reading, he was talking mainly about how that's such an important issue for him, unless that removes.
Almost like environment.
How do you see it here?
So,
in the design of the group?
I would call environment a resource. In as much as it's something that's available to the group, and I would call it a tool the more flexible it is. And again, with the there's a great book, maybe I'll bring it in next week, there's a great book by Stuart Brand called How Buildings Learn, in which he shows two buildings side by side in the French Quarter of New Orleans, ironically, as they were built in the 1890s identically, and by the 1980s they were radically different. The The outside shell of the building had changed very little, the real structure, but the inside, the interior decoration, changed quite rapidly. So in a way, the walls are closer to being a resource, and the table is closer to being a tool, but there's a spectrum there. The one other thing I will say, not because it's true of groups, but because it's true of this class, is that in as much as you were looking at physical environments, I'd ask you also to look at mediating effects. What does it mean to work on a screen instead of a whiteboard? What does it mean to video conference across space so that the room is partly real and partly virtual, and so forth? We have lots of good ways of understanding what it's like to carve out a room for a group to meet in and locate them there physically. We don't yet know much, although we have a huge amount of flexibility on trying to get the mediated piece of this involved in the environment. In some cases, groups are completely virtual, as with EverQuest, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of the really interesting work is being done around groups that are partly real and partly virtual, because what we used to regard as being, we're all going to be these big floating video heads, right, and we're going to get completely dissociate ourselves from the real world, is now turning out to be a spectrum where a lot of the middle points are actually quite a bit more interesting than some absolute endpoint where everybody knows each other online and doesn't know each other offline at all. It's quite apparent, for example, that on the listserv, a big part of the listserv's energy comes from the fact that people associate offline as well as online.
And the media is in a way similar or decreasing this distance, this gap. If you don't have the gathering or the physical communication eventually,
I'm sorry, the media is doing what?
Like TV or the internet. I mean, if you have a group, you don't know each other. So it seems like, or even pictures in the news, is enabling, it's a similar structure to the physical gathering. I'm just thinking, how was it possible to gather all these people in the French Revolution one day and do whatever they did? They didn't have the media in that sense. So that it's interesting. Or how does the mafia work? It is on gathering. It is on personal, physical communication.
There are bunches of. I mean, one of the really interesting things. I mean, we'll look at some of these case studies. But the defeat of the in Spain of the Partido Popular 4 days after the Madrid bombings. The ability to coordinate there across an enormously large area in a very short period of time, much of that fell to SNS. And in fact, the slogan of the anti-PPP movement was, who did it? Right? Because there was a big debate around the Madrid bombings of who had actually caused the Madrid bombings. The Basque were being blamed, but it looks like it was in fact Al-Qaeda. And who did it, of course, is an SMS-friendly message. So we'll look for places where those kinds of coordination effects both start in the real world and end up in the real world, and the media's in the middle. About the assignment for the week, we're going to begin the midterm. The midterm will be a paper, a set of observations written by you, but some of the background for the midterm will be built up in groups. And since it's three, I will mail you, it's five groups of three. I'm going to ask you to find a group to look at in the world that has both coordination problems, which is why I was asking for the input of the four or five groups that have coordination problems, that both have coordination problems and are mediated. And I'll ask you to report back next week. And I don't want more than just a very basic overview. This doesn't have to be elaborate, but just a group that both has coordination problems, has to organize meetings or what have you, and also arranges at least some and possibly all of its effects in media. So you could look at anything from a group on the floor at ITP trying to get a project done to a guild in World of Warcraft. Right? I'll send out a more complete write-up since I've run over time. And as I said, I'd ask people a bunch of questions in the comments in your papers. If you have answers, I'm actually interested in what they are. So mail me if you need them and have a reaction, or if you have questions or comments about them.
How many pages?
It's that?
It's overview? How many pages?
No pages. I'm just going to ask you to stand up next week and say something. No, there will be a written piece later, but that's not for next week.
Oh. Are we forming groups of three now, or?
What's that? I'll mail you the groups.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just go look at a group and tell me something about it. A couple classes.
Just give
it
a
time.
Yes.
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 Yes. Yes. Okay. But yeah, we'll definitely argue for your group choosing something over. So if it's something you can look at from the book, I mean.
On what